This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. David Mura is a poet. He lives in Minneapolis, and neither from his name nor his address would you know that his grandparents were all from Japan. Until he spent a year in Japan in 1984-85, Mura didn't spend much time thinking about his heritage or about why he had only gone out with non-Asian women, including his wife. But something deep inside him shifted after that year. It affected his sense of family, his sense of home, even his sense of body and sex. And he's written about it in a new book, Turning Japanese, Memoirs of a Sansei.
One of the things that I felt when I got to Japan and got off the airplane at Narita and saw everybody look like me was a feeling of surprise at how comfortable I felt in Japan and how much it meant to me that people around me looked like me, that when I turned on the TV, all the faces looked like mine, that everyone in the country from the prime minister to the person on the subway looked like me. And it gave me something to compare with what I felt in America, which was often a feeling of vague alienation or feelings of being different. And I think that I felt a certain amount of anger about how much that those feelings of alienation had been discounted or ignored by American culture.
Well, you talk about masks and the need to find masks and to discard masks and to remove the internal anger with another sort of expression.
Well, I think that my story goes back all the way to the relocation camps and what happened to my parents. When the Japanese Americans were put into the relocation camps, they were really put in there because they were Japanese Americans, not because they had done anything. There was no Japanese American who was ever convicted of espionage. And the way I like to talk about that experience is that if you are put into a prison because you're a shoplifter and you come out and you are a reformed shoplifter, what is it that you do? You don't shoplift anymore. So what happens if you're put into prison for being of Japanese ancestry? You come out and the implicit message is if you're going to be reformed, if you don't want to be put in prison again, you don't call attention to the fact that you're of Japanese ancestry. Now, when my father was in the camps, a white teacher told him, you will get out of the camps and after the war and you'll be back in American society, but for your sake, you should try to be not just one, but 200% American. And I think my father took that to be, I will try to be white middle-class American. I will really not try to call attention to anything in my Japanese background. And I think that's the way that he raised us. So that I think both from my parents and from the culture, I got a sense of, on the surface of, let's not talk about Japanese culture and let's pretend that we really don't want to call attention to ourselves as Japanese. And beyond that, I think a sense of self-neglect and self-hatred about my Japanese ancestry.
That's the David Mura who went to Japan.
And well, I think the David Mura who went to Japan, therefore, was somebody who really, in certain ways, didn't want to go to Japan, didn't want to be reminded of the fact that he had Japanese ancestors. I speak at the beginning of the book how when I won this fellowship to go to Japan, part of me wished that the prize was Paris, not Tokyo. And I say that I would have preferred French bread and brie over sashimi and rice and Roland Barthes over D.T. Suzuki and Zen.
Is that still true?
No, I don't think so. What happened once I got there was I think I fell in love with Japanese culture and with being in Japan and with felt this tremendous sense of pride both in the tremendous contemporary hustle and bustle of Tokyo and this brilliant neon city and also in various ancient parts of Japanese culture that I saw either touring or when I was in Japan, I studied the medieval Japanese drama No, which is still practiced today.
Your discoveries sound a lot like black people who went to Africa in the late 60s and discovered a world they really hadn't quite imagined. Even like gay people who went to San Francisco and suddenly found these new families. Mm-hmm. And your intellectual background is largely shaped by Frantz Fanon and others. How different is this search for a home from other subgroups in America, racial or otherwise?
Well, I think one difference is that I think it's nearly impossible to imagine American culture without Afro-Americans. You simply cannot imagine it. Whereas I think it is possible for people to think about American culture without thinking about Japanese Americans. So that the second thing is obviously there is a more virulent racism against Afro-Americans in this country. So there's a sense for them of both being a stronger part of the cultural fabric and yet at the same time being discriminated against on a greater level. The Japanese Americans have been sort of known as a sort of good, quiet, model minority. And I think that model was based on a thinking which said, don't call attention to yourself, try to blend in, try to, in essence, be as middle-class white as you can.
Well, many white Americans are inclined to say, surely there are abuses of race and class with many people, certainly with African Americans, with Latinos often, with Filipinos. But for Chinese Americans and Japanese Americans, there's certainly no income abuse by and large. Why should there be such an identification? And for Japanese Americans, they say that there's a great mixing that goes on. So, I mean, I think there is a puzzlement on the part of white people in this country.
Yeah, and I think that puzzlement is due to a lack of white imagination, and in part also because certain aspects of Chinese and Japanese American experience have not really been expressed in a wide way in the culture, and that is because they are not in control of what is shown and what is done in the culture. Even when, as recently, when Ellen Parker did the film Come See the Paradise, what had to happen was you had to have Dennis Quaid, a white guy, as the hero of the movie, about Japanese Americans being interned in the relocation camps. And there was an assumption there that even when you are telling a story of Japanese Americans, they are secondary to the white male who is the center of consciousness of that film. I think one of the things that both the Japanese Americans and the Chinese Americans share is a history of racism in this country, which is often not told. When you look, for instance, at the photograph of the railroads meeting east and west, what you see is a number of white faces. You don't see any of the Chinese who actually did the majority of the work on building that railroad. So that I think that part of the success, if Japanese Americans have moved into middle class, is because they have minimized their sense of difference, have tried to hide it. And I think one of the things that is changing now about a definition of what it means to be an American is that the object is not necessarily to meld in, to pretend you're like everybody else, but to say, I can be American, I can have come from a different cultural background, from a different history, and that history and that cultural background and the way that I look at the world is important, and it is American.
My guest is David Miura. He's the author of a new book, Turning Japanese, Memoirs of a Sansei. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Miura. He is a writer, a poet, who spent a year in Japan thinking about his Japanese and his American identity. David, this sense of your connection to Japan and your wife's increasing distance, it seems like, during the time you were there, is something you write about. You talk about how you were walking down the street one day with another friend, and well, maybe you can tell us what happened.
Well, I'm walking down the street with them, and with my wife, who's a Caucasian, and my friend Daniel, who's a corporeal mime, who's 6 feet two, and does stand out above the Tokyo crowds. And we come to a stoplight, and they begin to jaywalk. And they are jaywalking in part because they're playing on what we used to call a gaijin license, a foreigner's license. And that was that if you were a foreigner, you could pretend as if you didn't really know the Japanese rules. And so you could break the rules with a sense of impunity. And as they walk across the street jaywalking, I realize that if I jaywalk with them, even though I am a foreigner too, everybody will think that I'm Japanese. And so I don't walk across the I don't jaywalk across the street. And they kid me for being, you know, for being so stuffy and playing along with the Japanese rules. And I sit there and sort of chide them and say, you Americans, you think you own the world. And it's a curious sort of feeling as I watch them walk across the intersection and stand there at the other side waving me on, and my not feeling as if I could jaywalk, that I had to stand there with the Japanese crowd. And what I realized as I saw my wife over there with my friend Daniel was that there was a sort of gulf which had opened up between us in terms of who we were in Japan, and the ways that our racial backgrounds had affected, you know, how we looked at ourselves in that country.
David, this book is a lot about the body. Mm-hmm. Enormous amounts of its energy is given over, of your energy in writing about it is given over to thinking about your body. You talk about the eczema you suffered as a child, your sense of skin difference, the theater that you worked with, the dance theater there was very, very physical. It's a little unusual in these kinds of memoirs of looking of racial difference and of cultural difference to be so focused on the body.
Well, I think that the fact of talking about the body and skin color and the ways that those things affect your identity is something which oftentimes is really taboo in this society. Sometimes in the book I talk about little things about the body. For instance, I don't drink here and in the States, and one of the reasons why I don't drink much is because I turn red when I drink, and I found that after one drink I turn beet red, and everybody sort of points at me and laughs, and I feel embarrassed. And when I got to Japan and I go out drinking with Japanese friends, I'd look around and everybody around the table was all beet red, so I didn't have to feel odd. But beyond that, I think I was so struck when I got there, as I said before, with how it felt to look like everybody and to be able to meld into the crowd.
How did you come up with your choice of titles for the memoir, Turning Japanese?
Well, what the book charts in a way is the way in which I fall in love with Japan, and by the middle of the book, I feel like I'm turning Japanese. Everything around me, the food that I'm eating, the music that I'm listening to, what I'm speaking, I don't really want to think about going back to America. I don't really want to even think about American literature very much.
But as I understand it, the phrase also has another slang meaning in this country, and you're probably not unaware of it.
Well, actually, it's not in this country. It is a British slang term, and I was aware of it, and I really don't want people to think about it as they think about the title. It is a British slang term for masturbation, and it's a racist slang term, which is based on the idea that if you masturbate, your eyes sort of become slits. I tested the title on a number of people, and I found that most people... Some people had heard that there was a pop song in the early 80s. It was called Turning Japanese. and some young people had heard that song and knew that. Most people that I talked to, your experience may be different, did not know the meaning of this British slang term.
Thanks for being with us. My guest has been David Mura. He is the author of Turning Japanese, Memoirs of a Sansei.